Hello, everybody, and welcome to Pod on the Tyne, your go-to Newcastle United podcast brought to you by The Athletic. Anyone who listens to the podcast now can subscribe to The Athletic with a 40% discount by using the code NewcastlePod. So go to www.athletic.co.uk/NewcastlePod and get your 40% discount. My name's Taylor Payne, and I am joined, as ever, by the wonderful Mr. Chris Wolfe. How are we doing, Chris?
I'm very good, thank you. Very good.
It's lovely to hear your voice, mate. It's absolutely lovely.
That means a lot. That means a lot.
How's isolation going? Is it okay?
It's not too bad, thank you. Yeah, my back gate hasn't taken any mother battering, so we're all good.
That is always a bonus, isn't it? And also, of course, we're joined by Mr. George Cogg. And George, how are you? Are you okay?
Well, apparently I'm not wonderful. That's the first thing I'm noticing from your little introduction.
Don't you start pulling apart my introduction.
That was mealy-mouthed. That was mealy-mouthed,
Taylor.
We had that
last week. Right, okay. George, I'll tell you what, just reset. Also, ladies and gentlemen, I'm joined by the marvellous Mr. George Colgan. George, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yes, getting by.
Yes.
I prefer wonderful.
Wow. By the way, it's important that everybody knows that Chris's nickname is now officially either Waffles or Whiff Waff.
I mean, it's been the former for quite a while. You've just cottoned onto this. The latter is a new one. I'll give you that.
I'm happy with either or both of them.
Yeah, we can't refer to him as Chris anymore. It has to be Waffles or Whiff Waff.
Waffles, right? Okay, Waffles. Excellent. Can we call him Sergeant Waffles?
That's good. I like that. I don't know why. I mean, yes, we can. Why not?
Just to add
a
bird's eye potato
onto it.
No, you've spoilt it now, Waffles.
Yeah, come on, Waffles. Pack it in.
Captain Waffles.
Right, so we've got an action-packed, fun-filled show for you today. We've got lots and lots of stuff to talk about. We're going to have a little update on the takeover story to start with. We'll have a little chat about Newcastle United and what they've been doing during the coronavirus epidemic. And we're also going to be joined by a special guest in a little bit. We've got former Newcastle United and Northern Ireland international, Aaron Hughes, is going to be joining us for a lovely bit of a chat. That sounds all right, doesn't it, lads?
Yeah.
We're looking forward to that, yeah.
Nicest man in football, I think. I think that's his official title.
Is that right? Well, we shall soon see, won't we? Let's hope he lives up to that billing that you've given him, George.
Yeah, I mean, if that's he comes brilliant. On the line and immediately calls me a twat, then I'm going to be look very foolish. But, I mean, I don't think he's ever sweat.
I mean, he'd be right. But
I don't think he's ever sworn in his life, Aaron.
Oh, well, fair play. I mean, I noticed when I was doing my little bit of research that he never received a red card ever in his entire career.
Well, that just
so I think that kind of that bears out your opinion of him. Anyway, let's move on. So things have been moving at a pace in the last couple of days. We've had a few murmurs and rumours and things have been going around on the internet and in the media. And then last night, George, you put out a piece on The Athletic addressing the Newcastle United takeover situation at the moment. Is there anything else that we can talk about today? Can you give us a little update on where that is at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, what I think I want to do is put it into context, really. And that's really what I was trying to do with the piece I wrote. If we think back, it's something that I've talked about on the podcast, that we've talked about on the podcast when the story sort of originally broke at the end of January. But I haven't wanted to write something really until there was something sort of substantive to report and not kind of add fuel to the fire. And that was very much the approach I took and that we took at The Athletic, that really until there was something to sort of physically say, it's just going back over sort of similar old ground. Now, has that position changed? Up to a point, but it's for me, it also feels like it's gone on for so long now that not writing something just feels a bit strange. I don't want to get people overexcited for no reason. I don't want to kind of be part of that at all. But it did feel that when the story emerged over the weekend that the Premier League have been notified about this group's attempt to buy the club, that it's just passed beyond the point where saying nothing almost looks like we're dismissing it as something that shouldn't be considered. But, you know, also the response to that story was that this is PR on behalf of Mike Ashley or the club. He'd had a bad week with Sports Direct and this was just him trying to sort of put a smokescreen up. Now, I know for a fact that that's not the case. I mean, 100% the origin of these stories is not spin on behalf of Keith Bishop or anybody else attached to the club. It's not that. It is categorically not that. And really, the point of what I was writing was that Amanda Staveley's second attempt to buy the club has been a year in the planning and a year in the making. It's taken a very long time to get this coalition together, which includes the Saudi Arabia Public Investment Fund and the Rubin brothers, who were involved the first time. And it's been a painstaking process. It's been a painstaking process because it's very difficult to deal with Mike Ashley. And that's been proved countless times. And it's been very difficult because it's incredibly complicated. So, and the things that add to the complication are there are three principals on her side. There's her, there's the Rubin brothers, there's the Saudis. Any little changes in plans or contracts therefore have to go around three people and then go back to three sets of lawyers and then have to be agreed again. And of course, then have to go to Ashley. And then there are other things, for example, the HMRC investigation that have added huge levels of complexity, again, aside from things like due diligence and plans and stuff like that. And then, of course, what's happening now. So the point I was trying to make was this is not spin. It's not Ashley, you know, attempting to cover his tracks. I know that's
covering himself. Yeah.
Yeah. It's our, you know, this is a very natural reaction. For people to think that kind of stuff, and it's also reached a point where it's gone much further than any other attempt to buy the club, and therefore it's much closer to happening. However, the big point is they have to get an agreement signed and then sent to the Premier League for the owners and directors attest to happen, and that hasn't happened yet. So
just to clarify, George, I just want to double check something with you. The Premier League has been notified about the potential buyers. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the way it has to happen. So it's information about the potential buyers, but that gets submitted by the club. That's what I was told. But the Premier League,
but the directors' test stuff hasn't started yet. None of that stuff.
That's a completely different thing. What would happen is, my understanding is, what would happen is there'd be an agreement. A deposit would be paid. It goes to the Premier League for the owners and directors test. The feedback they've got is that that could take up to a month. And then if that's successful, then the full amount of money gets paid and it's done. I mean, you know, there could be a handover process, but I think there would be a handover process. But, at the moment, we've got everything that's going on in the world. New owners physically couldn't get to the ground and do the work they need to do because they're not allowed. I mean, I specifically made the point. I think it's not hashtag Cannes time.
We're not at hashtag Cannes just yet.
We're not at hashtag Cannes yet. But so really, that it was my attempt, and I don't want to get people overexcited, but I do want to. I did feel the need to put everything in context about this being something that's been a year in the planning. And it has now reached a very advanced stage. The next step is obviously, in some ways, it's the smaller step, and in some ways, it's also the bigger step.
Yeah. I mean, it would be just typical and the most Newcastle United thing in the world, wouldn't it? If as fans, we've waited all this time for something to happen like this, for Ashley to sell the club. And if the announcement is made in the next couple of months or something like that, we can't go to the pub and enjoy it. It's just the most Newcastle thing ever, isn't it?
There would be social media. I mean, social media, hashtag Cannes, you know, with little videos and pictures and stuff like that might be quite good fun. But yeah, no, I know. But we'd be storing up quite a good party.
Yeah, I've got a particularly nice bottle of vintage wine from my local Londis, which is sitting chilling, just waiting to open that.
I mean, you say,
I think it's from Slovakia.
It's Buckfast. It's Buckfast, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Chris, how are we feeling about this, about the takeover stuff?
I mean, similar to sort of what George has said, it's one of those things which I don't think anybody, including George and myself, will, until it actually is, if it does get concluded, until it actually reaches that point, your natural reaction is cynicism, because we've been here for 3 years or whatever it is. There's been two times before where Ashley's put the club up for sale and it hasn't happened. And so you do naturally just, your immediate reaction is one of scepticism and is this actually going to happen? But What I found most interesting about George's piece and when George has explained to me is that it's about the fact that the coronavirus situation hasn't actually affected this negatively as you might have thought as it would, in terms of everyone thinking, why would you do a massive business transaction this sort of time? And George explains in the piece, but you might just want to detail a little bit more about why actually the Saudis don't view this as just something which is going to affect in the short term. Because obviously there are going to be significant effects to all businesses as a result of this, but they haven't been put off because of that.
Thanks, Waffles. I suppose, yeah, I mean, that was my assumption as well, was, you know, why on earth would anybody at this point, when, you know, we have all this uncertainty and stock markets are kind of crashing everywhere, why on earth would you go out and make what is effectively a vanity purchase and a non-essential purchase at the moment? Well, the answer to that is that, although it doesn't feel like it at the moment, the coronavirus is a short-term problem. I mean, it might be a short-term problem that lasts for 6 months or a year, for all we know, but it's short-term. The way that the public investment fund works is very much long-term. It's a long-term view. And having given their commitment, or having given a commitment to do this, they'll see it through. So it isn't about selling the club in 6 months' time and making a quick profit. It's about what happens in 10 years' time or 5 years' time or, you know, whatever. And so that sort of stuff, I mean, they're rich enough to be able to afford to, if not ignore what's happening now, then to treat it as a short-term sort of issue. And so, I mean, you know, one of the other things that I've sort of talked about is what the price for the club is now. You know, there may be a sort of reduction in that and things. We'll have to see, you know, we'll have to see if and when. But, you know, they can afford to take a long-term view, and buying a football club from their perspective is a long-term proposition.
Okay, great. Well, it's great to get a little update on that anyway, and I think a lot of people enjoyed reading the piece that you put out last night. As we're talking about the coronavirus and from a business point of view as well, the announcement was made this week that Newcastle have chosen to furlough the non-playing staff, I believe, at the club, and in the wake of the coronavirus, the first Premier League team to do this. What's our take on this? I was a little bit surprised by this, to be honest.
Well, this is, so Spurs have subsequently followed today, actually. I mean, I don't know the specifics of Spurs. I just had a quick look before. But Newcastle were the first to do it. They've taken advantage of the government scheme which is out there. So the government, at least until the end of April when it'll be reviewed, will pay 80% of those non-playing staff wages. Newcastle are going to pay the remaining 20. So no staff are losing out in terms of, at least and certainly until the end of April, in terms of money. But it does sort of jar a little bit. I think it does feel a little bit uncomfortable because we're still in a situation where I mean, it's very much a skeleton staff right now working at Newcastle. Most of the media staff, most of the box office staff, even those at the foundation, which I think really strikes a discord with me, are in this position whereby essentially that they've been told for now they're not working until the end of April, and then the situation will be reviewed depending on what happens with the Premier League. Now, the biggest cost base is obviously the first team squad and the first team coaches. Now, it seems, as was reported on The Athletic yesterday, that there is a move of almost like a pan Premier League move to try and agree a reduction or deferral in wages across the entire Premier League, which seems to be why Newcastle haven't yet tackled that cost base. But just the fact that the rest of the staff have been put on furlough first doesn't quite feel right. It doesn't feel like that should have been the way around it was, given that the significant cost base really is from the first team squad, who are still at the moment, as far as we're aware, and at the club I'm denied, they're still getting paid the full amount of money.
One thing that I don't understand is, and you know, perhaps it takes somebody with more of a kind of financial brain than me, but you know, we know already that Newcastle have given away up to 10,000 half season tickets, so it's not as if they're losing out huge match day income, because they've already given that away, and so there is that commitment for the rest of the season. Now, a club like Spurs, fine, they're very, very rich, they bring in a lot of money, they've also just built a new stadium and have to service that debt, and I can see why match day income not coming in becomes a problem. I mean, I can understand that basic principle. It's different with Newcastle, and the other difference is, I mean, all businesses can have cash flow issues, but in football, everything gets paid in advance. So you get your TV money in advance, you get your sponsorship, you know how much is going to come in with all those things. And that hasn't, you know, that hasn't changed. And so I share Chris's discomfort with this, particularly when foundation staff were, you know, responding brilliantly only a week or so ago to the coronavirus situation and delivering stuff to vulnerable people. And, you know, I don't want to say stuff that might then prove not to be true, but it does. You know, we're constantly told that Newcastle are a self-sufficient club, profitable, financially are fine. And so I don't understand why they've had to take this move as quickly as they have.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I think especially in the aftermath of the last couple of weeks as well, of Mike Ashley coming in for some bad press and some bad stick with regards to his practices with Sports Direct and in relation to the coronavirus outbreak. I think this kind of, and then also the taking of the direct debits for the season ticket money as well. Now, I understand that's a transaction that's in place, and unless the person at the end of the direct debit cancels, that's going to go through anyway. But I think there's been a bit of bad press recently, and I think probably Newcastle United didn't really need this at the moment, did they?
No, I don't. And that's what I mean about it, the fact that it just seems... I mean, you're looking across the entire country, across the entire world, and businesses everywhere are being affected. And actually, one of the things that Daniel Levy says in his statement today is basically that people need to wake up, and that there's still being talked about 100 and whatever million pound potential transfers this summer. He says you have to understand how significant this crisis is. Now, I agree with Georgia in terms of just doing sort of the numbers. Newcastle don't seem to me as if they'd be in the worst position compared to others. They made a profit the last time they had the accounts out. According to David Ornstein, our colleague, the Premier League clubs got the latest tranche of payments in February from the TV companies. Now, I know that there's a concern that if they can't complete the league, they'll have to pay that back. But at the moment, in theory, they have that. There was a transfer budget available in January for Newcastle, so in theory, there was money there. I know there can be cash flow issues across the course of the season, but in theory, there was money there. And so it doesn't sit... Because the players haven't been put in the same sort of situation yet, it doesn't feel right. And I just feel that in terms of that PR move of why is it, say if there's an agreement at the end of this week or start of next week with Premier League players, was it such a situation that Newcastle couldn't afford to even get to the end of this week or whatever it is by this? Yeah. It doesn't seem to add up, but as George says, we don't know the ins and outs. We don't know exactly what the money is, but it just doesn't quite sit right at the moment.
Well, let's wait and see what happens with that one, yeah? It's a difficult period at the moment for everyone, and we've been invited by our overlords at The Athletic to mention a local business or two and to give them a little bit of publicity. We've each been asked to choose a local business, and me and Chris both chose the same business, unbeknownst to each other, which I think says more about me and you, Chris, than it does about anything else. And we've chosen the Geordie Banger Company, which is a range of handmade sausages, which are produced in North Shields and have all kinds of different flavours. But I have to say, my personal favourite is the brown ale sausage. It is unbelievable.
Oh, that is a good sausage. I like a good sausage, particularly a sausage on a stick, as they do.
Can we clip
that bit?
Yeah. Yes, please. That's exactly what I was going to say to our Athletic overlords. Please, can we just clip that? That's all I want.
Oh, that is a good sausage. Yes.
That's all I want to hear for the rest of my life.
But what I didn't realise, Taylor, having looked at their website, and I have been, and I have regularly got a sausage on a stick. They do all these sort of, they go to different food festivals and whatnot, and markets. But apparently, they do a peas pudding dip to put your sausage in, which I did not know. Again, right, Chris, that probably sounded very wrong. But
this is not the time for dirty talk. Okay, Chris, let's
carry
stop
on
that.
Sausages. With Sergeant Whiff-Waff.
Oh, George, what about you? Is there a local business that that you would like to give a little shout out to or mention to?
Yes, I would like to mention the Pink Lane Bakery, who have a couple of outlets, but one, their most recent one's in Gosforth, and they're still open, and they're providing lovely, amazing bread, amazing croissant, things like that, and great people. I think they're magicians when it comes to baked goods. Not in the sense that they, well, they make them and then they disappear. So maybe that is that's what I mean. But yeah, beautiful. And I like to just say, you know, obviously, thank you to all the people who are working in, whether it's local kind of companies like that or big supermarkets and things like that. They're, you know, they're doing a different job to the people in the NHS, but you know, we need them, and you know, they're putting themselves in the front line to make sure that we've got food and drink and all the rest of it. So big thanks to all of them.
Yeah.
The Geordie Banger Company have a drive-up, a little drive-up window that you can go to, and you get you get drive-through sausages in packets, which is amazing. Why nobody has ever thought of this before? A drive-through sausage emporium. It's the future. Anyway,
well, that's this week's band name, isn't it? The Drive-Through Sausage Emporium.
Drive-Through Sausage Emporium, yeah.
There's always one.
Oh, it's in! Can you believe it? I think it's the skipper. It's his first international goal. Aaron Hughes, I thought he was never going to score, and he's put Northern Ireland on their way.
Welcome back, everybody, and we are absolutely delighted to announce we have a special guest with us today. Ladies and gentlemen, please be upstanding for Mr. Aaron Hughes. Hello, Aaron, how are you doing?
Morning. Oh, no, sorry, good afternoon. It's afternoon now, isn't it?
That's a good start.
That's what happens when you've been locked away for this long. The days and the time just blends into one big, long, continuous sort of thing.
The days get away from you, don't they? Yeah. How are you doing, Aaron? Are you good? Are you well? Where are you at the moment?
Yeah, I'm just in the house, like everyone else should be.
And where is that?
In Northumberland, up close to Morpeth. So, fantastic. just in the house, and then not really up to much. But then I guess that's just the way things are at the moment, obviously.
So you're still in the northeast as well? Yeah, I didn't realise that you were still up here. That's fantastic.
Just not long back, actually. Not long back. Brilliant. Sort of moved back middle of last year. So. Enjoying being back in an area that I know quite well.
Fantastic stuff. So what have you been doing with yourself since retiring from football anyway? What's the day-to-day goings-on of Aaron Hughes?
It's been a strange time because I've been trying to take a little bit of time off just to enjoy not having to go into training every day, the schedule and all, you know, everything else. But at the same time,
yeah.
I get bored quite quickly, so I'm trying to find things to fill my time. In terms of work, I've done a little bit of media stuff, and I'm actively, you know, up until, you know, the last couple of weeks where things have shut down a little bit, you know, just looking to see what's out there. And I've started an executive master's in sports management, which is geared more towards sort of the admin side of football, like you know, like a sporting director, academy director, you know, stadium manager, something that stays in sport but just isn't involved directly on the pitch, like a coach. The way it worked out in terms of my coaching badges, the timing of it, you know, I'm not going to be able to start my license until, you know, maybe May or June, obviously, if things go back to normal. So in that time, there was a bit of a gap to maybe try and fill it with something else, and the opportunity came up to do this. So I thought it would be something good to add to the, you know, sort of, I guess, the overall package of, you know, when I do finally find myself back in work somewhere.
And Aaron, you played forever. I mean, you effectively played until last year, didn't you? Did you, I mean, you must have known that was coming. You must have seen it kind of coming for a while. But did it still come as a shock? Has it come as a shock not playing? I mean, so many players say that it is a struggle, that you have all this structure in your life and then suddenly it's gone. Have you sort of experienced that as well?
I have, actually, and it's, I don't think anything can prepare you for it as much as you know it's coming. And with me, I knew it was coming, but I didn't really know when, because for the last couple of seasons, I almost made the decision. I left it right up to the end of the season to see where I was going. You know, after Brighton, I went out to Australia, and I'd sort of planned to go out to Australia and maybe stay out there for a couple of years, just to, you know, even if I wasn't playing football, retire out there, just see where life would take me type things after the Euros finished. But then because of the success in the Euros, and because I found myself, you know, playing, and I wanted to have another go, you know, at trying to qualify for a World Cup, because I thought that at the time the squad was good enough that, you know, to have a real good go at it. You know, ultimately, we just missed out in a playoff, but it blew a career by another 2 years. And rather than having some sort of a plan or that, it was very much trying to just you know, do things on the hop. You know, we moved back to the UK with no, you know, no club and nowhere to live. It was very hard to plan and to really prepare for, like, all right, this is, you know, at the end of the season, I'm definitely finishing, because I didn't really know when that was going to be up until close to the end of last season. So, and then everything that comes after that, the structure, you know, it's just different. And I think even for the most prepared people, the most settled people, everything, I think that immediate sort of getting pulled out of the environment you've been so used to for so long is a shock for anyone.
You obviously, I mean, I love the fact that you've come back, to the Northeast. And my very strong opinion is that you should never have gone in the first place. But that wasn't your decision. But because you came through the ranks at Newcastle, obviously you were born in Northern Ireland, and that's where you spent your childhood. But you came over to Newcastle early and came through the ranks. Does an experience like that prepare you for life in lots of ways? Because I know we often think about footballers' lives having this sort of amazing lifestyle and all that kind of stuff, but that's a pretty tough thing to have to do, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think probably I only think about it like that now when I'm older, because when you're 16, it's exciting and the world's in front of you, and it's just what you have to do. There's no real bigger thought process around it than that. It's, you know, you really go and try and have that career, lifestyle, everything that goes along with it. It's what's in front of you. So you almost don't think, as you get older and you appreciate it a little bit more. And certainly when you get to where I'm at now, and, you know, I have a 16-year-old daughter now, I think to myself that the thought of her leaving home to go away, you know, is sort of boggles the mind, quite thing. And then I think, well, that's exactly what I did at my age. So it's like everything. I think as you get older, you get a different sort of view on it and a slightly different appreciation. And I certainly didn't think of it like that at that age, but it probably in hindsight was, you know, quite a big thing, quite a big step for me, and certainly does prepare you for things later in life, for sure.
It must have been really weird coming into Newcastle in such an exciting time in the mid-90s, mid to late-90s as well, and coming in with all of those, you know, what you would call star players at the time, and Newcastle at the time were flying and had a very good team. It must have been quite daunting for a young lad like yourself to come in into that situation.
It was certainly exciting. You know, when you've got the chance to go and, you know, join a club which is competing for the Premier League, you know, it's one of the top clubs in the country at the time. That side of it's really exciting. And, you know, the opportunity, you think of what's ahead, and the players, you know, walking into training and the first team players are walking past you, you know, and you, like the stature and you know, the way you look at them then, it's just incredible as a kid of that age to go in. And again, daunting, yes, you obviously know the scale of what you're getting into, but I think that young innocence, again, it's just exciting. You just go after it. It is nervous being around, you know, at that age, and players, again, when you look at them at that time, who some of them would later become sort of teammates, I guess. Yeah. They are playing in the same team as them, but at the time, you know, they were the first team players. They were the guys that, yeah, as young players, we looked up to and really put on a pedestal. And I think that's where that was quite daunting, when, you know, you were going to maybe train with them sometimes, you know, that we would get the chance to go along and, you know, train alongside the first team. And I think that's where the sort of the nerves and where you felt a bit daunted and overwhelmed sometimes, where you wanted to just go and not make a fool of yourself. But as I say, the more we get used to that, the easier it got and the more comfortable we felt with it.
One of the things we've done, Aaron, is to sort of ask on Twitter about to see if Newcastle fans have any questions they'd like to ask you. And one from Kingy66, it's extraordinary to think back to this, that you actually made your first team debut for Newcastle at the Nou Camp, playing against Barcelona in the Champions League. I mean, his question is, were you sort of too young to appreciate that at the time? But I mean, what an extraordinary place and time to make your debut for the club.
Yes and no to the answer. Was I too young to appreciate it? Again, going back to the sort of previous, what we're talking about before, in terms of it being a, you know, being a young player and looking at this, you know, to be part of the first team, to be part of that environment and the players that are playing, I think I understood being in that, it was a big thing. You know, it was more, it wasn't so much making my debut at the Nou Camp, it was more so finally making my debut in the Newcastle first team with the players that were around or coming through that process. But now looking back, I mean, it's a nice thing to have on your CV, and you know, it's a nice talking point. And obviously, everyone remembers the game, and there was, I think there was probably only, what, 25,000-30,000 in the stadium. It was surreal. The actual game was surreal, and everything around it. I have very little memories of the actual game. It's more, you know, some of the feelings and just standout sort of snapshots in my mind of, for some reason, things that I can remember. But I did appreciate it at the time. I knew what it was, but I think in a way I do get, like, when you look back, it's probably even better than what it was at the time, because I didn't think about it. I just wanted to go and play and make my debut and do well and not let anyone down. And afterwards you come off the pitch and you think, wow, I've just made my debut.
I don't think there's many players who made their debut at the Nou Camp for Newcastle, did they, in the Champions League? That's quite a big thing, let's be honest.
It is. It's a nice, like I said, it is a nice thing. And I'm not trying to downplay it or that. It's just, it's more so when you at that time, you know, you're not thinking in that terms. You're just, or I was just thinking, you know, it's. I remember just thinking of, I've finally made my debut for the first team, you know, and it's, you know, that was the overall emotion. Like I say, now looking back, it's just nice to have the fact that it was a Barcelona Nou Camp added to it, because it makes it quite a nice little thing on the CV.
Thanks to our good pals at beer52.com, you have the opportunity to sip 8 delicious, painstakingly sourced craft beers from around the world. All you need to do is go to www.beer52.com/tyne and pay the postage of just $4.95. And if that wasn't enough, as listeners to Pod on the Tyne, you'll get 2 extra free beers. Beer 52 are beer pioneers. They travel the globe and find the best and most interesting beer from the very best craft breweries. They are now the world's most popular craft beer discovery club. Each month, Beer 52 deliver a case with a different theme. Themes have included Germany, Korea, Belgium, South Africa, California, New Zealand, and many more. As an independent UK company, Beer 52 are also passionate about the UK craft beer scene. The beauty of Beer 52 is that you can leave at any time. The power is in your hands. Your case will also include the award-winning craft beer magazine Ferment, and a beery snack is thrown in too. Just go to www.beer52.com/tyne to get your case free. And don't forget, right now, listeners to Pod on the Tyne get 2 extra free beers.
I wanted to ask you about the Sheffield Wednesday game. What was that occasion like? Because I think you scored the first, if I'm correct, in the 8-0, and obviously it was just after Sir Bobby came in. I mean, what was that? What was the day like? What was the change in mood at the club as well?
I mean, the change, the mood at the club straight away was a lot different, and I think, again, I think looking back on it, everything I seem to, I have more appreciation looking back on things, because at the time, it, you know, you're in the middle of it and you're just trying to process. And for me, it was a new manager's coming in. I've got to try and do well and, you know, make sure I just play well, train well, all the rest. So you don't, almost then, don't fully understand what's going on around. But I remember the atmosphere of that game. I remember the lead up to it. I remember, you know, Sir Bobby pulled me before the game, a couple of days before, to say I was going to play, because I think it's, he mentioned in his book as well, I think they had the option of bringing in Colin Hendry at the time, but he decided that he wanted to, you know, give sort of youth a chance at the club, and I was, you know, in that position at the time, and he gave me the chance. So even that, my focus was very much on, right, I'm playing at the weekend, you know, what do I have to do to play well or prepare myself? And you block out a little bit of what's going on the outside. But, you know, the atmosphere that day was electric. It was a lot of excitement. You know, sort of Bobby's first game. It couldn't have gone any better, personally, for the team, you know, for the club, for just the whole occasion, for Sir Bobby himself. It really, you know, was a fantastic occasion. And, like, memory, when I say memory, again, I don't have lots of memories of the game. I don't even really remember the goal. I have a snapshot in my mind of it coming across. And right before, actually, I think it had come from a set piece, and I was making my way back. And I remember Nobby almost physically pushing me back into the box, going, "Where are you going? Stay off." I don't know why. It's just in my head. And then, obviously, I remember the ball coming in from Kieran on the left. And I knew as soon as it left, I knew as soon as I headed it, it was going in. I don't know why. It's just one of those things that you have as a footballer. Sometimes you instantly know the flight of the ball or the moment it leaves your foot or your head. I just knew it had enough on it to go in the corner and I wasn't going to get it. And then after that, I don't really remember much else. But no, it was great to be a part of that day. And certainly it was great for at the time, I guess as a young player, when a new manager comes in, to know that he had the option of being able to buy someone or bring someone in, you know, an established senior player who played vast experience, you know, who certainly could have done a good job for him to give a young player a chance, you know, being me. I think that straight off the bat gave me a lot of confidence going forward, as I knew that, look, if I work hard and do well here, I'm going to get a chance in the side, or I'm going to get a chance to play for this manager.
And then, of course, that led to that kind of beautiful, you know, Indian summer under Sir Bobby, where the club gets back into the Champions League, is challenging at the top again. You won't be surprised to know that this has been a question asked by several people, including by Ketch, who says, what is your favourite Sir Bobby memory? Because I will not accept that you don't have one.
there's probably a few. I mean, I remember he came into a team meeting. I think it was Charlton away. I'm sure it was down in London. It might have been West Ham. And he came in, and obviously we were in our suits or whatever. And he hadn't realised he tucked his shirt into his boxer shorts under his trousers. But they were Looney Tune characters. I think that one of his grandkids had bought him for Christmas or a birthday or something. And so we could see the top, we could see the band of like these, like, you know, Daffy Duck, Bugs Bunny, whoever else was on it. And he started the team meeting, and obviously everyone sat there and trying not to laugh. And the more you try not to laugh, the more you can't help but start to snigger. And then it was like a snowball effect, because everyone was trying to like not look at it, but couldn't help look at it. And then the person next to you would start to like sort of, their shoulders would start to go. So your shoulders would start to go. So the person next to you. And within a couple of minutes, like even JC was having a little giggle at the back, you know. And like after a couple of minutes, like, you know, Sir Bobby was like, "Okay, you know, what is it? What am I missing? You know, what's so funny?" And JC obviously pointed out that you know, we could see his. Like, he took it quite well. He laughed. He said, "Yeah, a little present from my grandkids or something," and swiftly moved on. And straight away, it was back to sort of business. There was no time to enjoy it. But I remember that, and then. There was one, I mean, there was one, there's loads. I remember Juventus away in the Champions League, and we, right at the end of the session, we'd sort of split up into different groups of strikers. We'd do some shooting, you know, midfielders, some crossing, whatever. And he took the defenders just to work on actually some heading, you know, like from attacking set pieces. And I can't remember who, I can't remember if the quality wasn't good enough from the side of the crossing in, or whether we didn't have the players because they were up the other end doing something. But he actually started clipping balls in himself from outside, like from the left wing and from the right wing. And every time it was on the money, every time. Couldn't believe it. Like, you know, and I think what he would have been, I don't know, probably close to 70 at that age. And he was just clipping things in, right foot, left foot. And again, like it's things like that stick out in my head more. Just like his enthusiasm, you know, is wanting to do that. And then probably one, I don't know if you guys remember it, there was one, we were away in the Champions League again, and the night before the game, when the press get to come to the stadium and watch, and he was doing a drill, and he was running backwards, and he stumbled and actually fell and did a backwards roll, popped straight back up on his feet and kept going as if it didn't happen. And obviously all the press were there. And again, it's just another one of those moments where you, like, oh, everyone looks at each other and like, did that just happen? And had a little giggle, and he just carried on as if nothing had happened, and they'd literally just fallen over in the pitch. But yeah, it's, that was Sir Bobby. He just was full of energy, full of life. You know, little. I'm sure there's loads of other little ones like that. But you know, we could end up talking about that all day. He was brilliant. He was fantastic. And again, to go back to the appreciation thing, I really wish I had spent more time picking his brains and asking him questions. And you know, it's one of the biggest things I regret you know, not really appreciating the experience and the players that he'd worked with and the things that he'd done. Obviously, I knew them as a player out playing under him. I knew who he was and what he'd done. But everything was very much the present in Newcastle and trying to impress him and trying to do my job from there and then. And then now looking back and looking, I just think I should have asked more questions. I should have asked him for more stories, you know, asked him about what was it like to be at Barcelona, PSV, work with Ronaldo, just different things, because he's the type of manager that would have sat and told you about it all day, you know, and really, really given his time like that. So, you know, didn't as much as you know, I did appreciate that. There's that side. I wish I still had more time.
Ah, fantastic stories though, Aaron. Aaron, one of the things I remember about watching you when you were at Newcastle was your versatility as a player as well. You were very much a Swiss Army knife kind of player, and you had a lot of different positions. What would you say is your best position, and what would you how would you attribute that to your versatility? And a guy called Dean Woods has asked that on Twitter as well.
I always considered myself a centre back. You know, that was what I came to the club as. That where I was most comfortable. You know, for the first season, you know, people actually forget. For one of the first season, I played a lot of left back. You know, when Bobby first came to the club and filled in a role then. You know, and then sort of later went across to right back. But it was just, you know, it wasn't. I wasn't really in a position to go, oh, you know what, Gaffer, left back's not my position. I don't really want to play there. I'm a centre back. You know, it's like I have the chance to play and I'll play at left back and I'll go in and I'll do as well as I can. And if I'm doing a good enough job to keep my place for that, then great. If not, well, at least I've given it a go. And that's sort of how it came about, playing different positions. I'd play where I was asked. And obviously when you start getting compared, that you then start getting compared to right back and trying to play as well as you can every week and constantly seeing, oh, we need a new right back, you know, we don't have a natural right back, this, that and the other. And it's like, well, it's true, but I wouldn't class myself as a right back myself. So the mentally actually was harder trying to get around it and trying to constantly prove people that I could do a job there while understanding I was never fully that wasn't the most natural position. But I that being said, like I got sold Aston Villa as a right back, which is right. Crazy when I look back at it. Even when I went from Fulham to QPR, I went there as a stand-in right back, and that was at 34, 35 years of age. So it's a position that I wouldn't say I'm a natural at by no means, but I think I understand it enough to play it, and I'm probably being a little bit more defensive minded. I can do a job there because I guess for a right back, well, maybe not so much now in the modern game, they have to be a little bit more offensive. But certainly then I could get away with a little bit more because I could just sit in and just play, you know, do a job. I understood the role, understood the position. And yeah, okay, maybe weren't going to get as much down the right side with me in terms of attacking. But that was, I knew my limitations, put it like that. So I maybe knew how to just play that role without making too much of a mess of it.
I think with all that in mind, though, Aaron, a lot of Newcastle fans, when you speak to them about you and about your time here, the word that always comes up for me is consistency. And it was that you were always there. You were always, you know, there or thereabouts, 7.5, 8 out of 10 every single week. You never shirked. You always did your job properly. And like you say, you might have been uncomfortable in those positions, but from a fan's point of view, I don't think any of us ever realised that, you know.
I'm sure if you dig through some of the archives and the old paper cuttings, you'll find a few four out of tens and five out of tens.
Do you think? I don't remember any, but I'll take your word for it. I mean, you were there, so
definitely.
I mean, Aaron, obviously, you through the longevity of your career, you played with a lot of very good players. You played a lot against a lot of very good players. Kevin Monaghan's asked, who was the best defender you played with, and who was the best striker or offensive player you came up against as well?
I'm assuming like as in like this is the best defender I guess at Newcastle rather than of all time or much.
Well, this is a
career.
Newcastle podcast, but you know, don't let that hold you back.
no, it's more so from like the one you come up against. It's always a difficult one because the fact that the club we're playing in Europe. You know, you not only are coming up against the best strikers in the Premier League every week, you're then sort of coming up against the best strikers in Europe and you know, that type of thing too. So I always find those questions quite difficult to answer, not just because there's so many players, but because of the amount of years that I've played at Newcastle too. you know, it changed. Like, I played against Totti quite early on, played against Kluivert when he was at Barcelona. Like, that, you know, at the time they were world class, you know, top strikers. Even, you know, look through the Premier League at the time, you've got Henri, you've got Drogba, you've got you know, you've got Rooney, like Owen. It's so hard to pick one out of like a long list like that to say, oh, this was the best one. You know, even playing against Duncan Ferguson, you know, one of my first games was in the FA Cup down at Everton, and playing against Duncan, it's a totally different game to playing against someone like Ronaldo on the wing. Because firstly, we all know Duncan, you know, he's so physical and so strong, but he was so good with his feet as well.
It's a baptism of fire, that, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's, you know, it is. So it's like, it's how do you pick? You know, it's very, very hard to pick. But in terms of defenders, again, like when I came to the club as a young player, like it's Steve Howe, Darren Peacock, and Philippe Albert. You know, and three maybe different centre halves in terms of their attributes, but three like great defenders. And at a time when the club was like I said, fighting to compete, you know, to win the Premier League. So, and then going forward from that, you know, I played with Woody when he was at the club. You know, he went on to play for Real Madrid. He was, but for injury, he would have been one of the best centre halves England's ever produced. He still is in a sense, but more consistently, I guess. I don't know. I maybe waffle through that question and just throw names at you, but it gives you a sense of it's quite a hard question to ask.
Yeah, I think that's kind of very interesting, and it kind of leads me on to, I suppose, the next part of your career, because, you know, Bobby has that incredible, you know, that incredible spell, very successful. It ends sourly, and there's that sort of feeling within the club at that point that a manager needs to come in to kind of get a grip of discipline. That was certainly the narrative that was kind of played out at the time. And Graham Souness comes in, and things are different. And, you know, there was some success in cup competitions and so on. But I think in your final season at the club, John Alan Boomsong arrives and Celestine Babiaro, and with all due respect, and this is me saying this, not you, but clearly they're not of the same calibre, I would say, as some of those players that you've mentioned, and they were playing in your position. Did you feel to yourself at that point that maybe the writing's on the wall? Did you think to yourself, this is just a challenge I have to rise to again? Could you sense that the end was coming? I'll go on a rant at some point, probably when you've answered this, but maybe tackle that first.
I didn't think the end was coming, as in, oh, that's it. I'm done now. Because I was still playing. I was still, like, you know, maybe not consistently playing, but I was still playing. But there is that doubt in the back of your head, and that obviously Graham came in that season. You know, it got to January, and two of the players he bought were a centre back and a full back. You know, both positions of which I had been playing or could play, or, you know, bolster the defence. So there is that doubt in the back of your head, and, you know, wondering what's going to happen, you know, once the season finishes. Because, like I say, because we were still having relative success on the pitch and being involved. You know, we went to the, I think it was a semi of the FA Cup that year, and then we the quarterfinals of the UEFA Cup that year. So there was still success on the pitch as such, in a way. And I was still personally still playing and being involved in a lot of those games. So there wasn't immediate dread or anything, but like I said, understanding the situation, I think it was more so, you know, maybe wonder what will happen in the summer. Will more players come in my position, or will, you know, sort of start to be the beginning of the end, whatever. But yeah, it's definitely in the back of the mind, maybe without being a, you know, an immediate worry.
I mean, I was furious when you left. I mean, because I think there was this sort of arrogance about the club that, you know, somehow they were outgrowing players. And, you know, you then look at the rest of your career, going to Villa first of all, you know, being established there, and then going on to Fulham and having a very, very long time there. And, it, you know, for me, you were the type of player who should be growing at the football club. You should be growing with the football club. And, you know, your versatility was a great strength. But there was also your professionalism. You know, I would always describe you as the most professional footballer that I kind of know. And you know, you should have grown with the club and the club should have grown with you. And it felt to me like you were discarded a little bit. And, you know, you should have spent, as far as I'm concerned, you should have spent the rest of your career at the club.
I don't really know how to answer that.
Well, you could just say thank you if you want. You can just say thank you.
I was going to say it's very kind words. And yeah, obviously, it's football. It's how it happens. I think at the time I maybe didn't understand it as well, just because it was my first time I'd moved, and maybe because I wasn't expecting it as such, or just not quite as sudden. I wasn't too sure how to deal with it, and I maybe for the first time saw the more brutal side isn't the right way to say it, but it's the only way I can describe it. But the more brutal side of football is, in that one minute you're a player, it's been at a club for a long time, and the next you're basically, no, that's it, you're done, we're done with your services, you know, you can move on. And that's that. I don't maybe think that's how it was. That's just how it felt, because it, like I say, I was still relatively young. It was my first time being in that position, and not only that, but it was leaving Newcastle. It was my first club, and a club that I'd grown up at and that I considered a home. And so you've got all those emotions going on too that add to it, that maybe cloud the judgment of, you know, the business side of football, and that players come and go and they move. So it was a hard one to take, and I didn't, again, like, obviously I wasn't in a position where I was thinking I had to move or I wanted to move. So even that, I sort of felt I was moving, not fully wanting to do it, but maybe having to do it in terms of my career, because, you know, Newcastle have said that, you know, they're willing to sell me on. So, but yeah, look, it happens, and it is this football, and I look back, and it's just one of those things. And, you know, I went on and was able to have other experiences elsewhere and enjoy my football. So, you know, in the bigger picture, it wasn't the end of the world, but at the time it did feel a little bit like it, I'll be honest.
So, Aaron, I just want to throw a couple of numbers at you here, and I don't want to embarrass you with any of these numbers, but I feel it's important for our listeners, because we have got listeners from all different ages and stuff, and there might be some listeners who didn't get to see you play at Newcastle. I want to just chuck some numbers at you here. So you played 455 games in the Premier League. The longevity of your career is something that I don't think you see very often in the game. I know there's a lot of players who go on and play for a lot of years, but I think to play the amount of games you did for the amount of teams you did, and a guy on Twitter, Johnny Gabriel, made the point that he realised that you had played alongside Ian Rush and Aaron Moy, which he found was an absolutely ridiculous stat. 205 games for Newcastle and 4 goals, never sent off, and I think we have to kind of applaud you for that. How did you keep going all that time? I mean, you know, you have a lot of players who get hit with injuries and stuff like that. Was there a particular secret to what you were doing? Is there a reason why you played? Are you some sort of machine? Are we unaware of you being a cyborg? How the hell did you do it?
I don't really know. Like, there's no. I always put that down. So certainly. You know, obviously, as I got older, that it maybe didn't feel quite as much like a machine, you know, and started to pick up little niggles here and there, and they take a little bit longer to get by. And I think as you get older too, you start to understand your body more. You know when you can push yourself and not, and you know this. You know, you get into a routine of looking after it. But I always sort of put it down to when I was young. Like, I was outside all of the time, and I tried to play as many different sports as possible. Like, whatever, like in the summer when the tennis courts came up at my school, for example, we'd play, you know, football, tennis, or we'd just play tennis. And then obviously when the courts came down, you know, through the winter, then it opened up the whole court just to play five-a-side. Or, you know, in the summer I'd do athletics, and I'd play like field hockey as well as football. And I just loved being out and loved playing sports. And this might be totally wrong, and it's just my, you know, I've got no sort of scientific evidence to back this up, but I think because of that, I was maybe just naturally well-rounded in terms of, you know, just being durable, you know, and just had a good base of strength and activity that allowed me to do lots of things. And you know, I don't know. Again, I'm waffling a little bit, and there's no scientific evidence. But one of the reasons that sometimes I think, like nowadays, like I always, you know, when parents say, oh, you know, what should we do with our kids, you know, in terms of putting them in academies and football, and they play football, like how many nights a week they should play. And I actually sort of, my advice would be, yeah, of course, football, if that's your main goal, like, you know, as much as you can, but try and get them as rounded as possible, get them involved in other sports, because it develops other movements and things that you can apply on a football pitch. And I you know, you see a lot of like young players now at 14, 15, 16, picking up injuries that you used to associate with a pro that had been in the game maybe 10, 12 years, just because, you know, they're coming into academies now that's so young, and it's just so repetitive, and they're doing the same things, and their bodies aren't developing fully. So not they're not developing fully, but they're you know, they're maybe not getting that, you know, exposure to all different movements and that, and you know, and that's what's giving them the strength. So again, I have absolutely no scientific basis to prove this on. It is just my theory as to why maybe I was able to go for the length that I did, and you know, touch wood, I didn't have any serious injuries. And
so there you go. Aaron Hughes is definitely not a cyborg. We've just put that to bed. Finally, yeah, on the pod on the time. Chris, do you want to wrap things up for us?
Yeah, just one final question. I mean, that longevity brought you 112 caps for your country across like 20 years. I mean, you captained wins over sort of England, Spain. There was the Euro 2016 you got to. I mean, just what was that like for you in terms of when you look back at your career, those moments for Northern Ireland and pulling on that sort of jersey that many times? How special was that?
I think it doesn't matter where you're from, how big your country is, or, you know, how many World Cups you've won, or, you know, how many games you haven't won type thing. Your country is your country, and it's a massive like honor, I guess, to play for it. And yeah, like my goal with Northern Ireland was always, I always wanted to go to a major finals. That was one thing that I always wanted, and it went above any amount of caps or amount of games or anything like that. And it was briefly why I retired from Northern Ireland, because I got to the point where I just thought it's never going to happen. You know, we just keep making the same mistakes. You know, that's another story. But I just got to the point where I was a little bit disillusioned and wanted to concentrate on my club career. And then when Michael came in and could feel there was something changing, and, you know, just how he was talking and the things he wanted to do. And not only that, he put a lot of emphasis on how special it would be to get 100 caps. It just, to then to go, you know, 5-6 years further down the line to get 100 caps, and then to go to a Euros, was just, you know, that was, when you say, you know, that was the dream, and then you end up, you know, living the dream, so to speak. And even at that, like at the time, I hadn't, you know, I was playing very little club football, and I knew I was probably going there as a squad player, you know, and wouldn't get very little playing time. So as a bonus, I actually got to play in 3 out of the 4 games, which surpassed all expectations. And it's the highlight of my career. I've had lots of good moments in my career, lots of special memories, but I think that has to be at the top, just because it's international football, you know, at a major tournament, and being able to be involved directly on the pitch it's something that, you know, I definitely won't forget.
That's amazing, Aaron. Thank you very much. I wish it feels like we've only scratched the surface, really, and could talk about this kind of stuff all day. But I do want to say, firstly, a huge thank you for coming on the podcast, but a sort of wider thank you, which is really, you know, you stood for something really important. You are, you would be top of the list in terms of most unassuming footballers I've met and have watched. And certainly, you know, so as I said before, certainly, you know, if I had to kind of name the archetypal professional, you would again be top of that list. Incredibly dedicated. I'm moved and touched beyond words that you've come back to the Northeast. This is your home, and so it should be, and I hope you'll always think of Newcastle as your home. And I hope, you know, I hope you'll come back on and have a chat to us again, because it feels like there's lots more we could talk about. But you're not only an absolutely brilliant fella, you were a brilliant footballer, and you deserve recognition for that. And thank you very much.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me on, George. Thank you. Cheers, guys. Thank you.
Thank you so
much. No problem, Aaron. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a fantastic little chat. We've really, really enjoyed it. And stay safe, and love to you and the family up there in Northumberland as well. Look after yourself, and we'll hopefully speak to you again in the future. It's been great. Thanks a lot, mate. There you go. That was lovely, wasn't it? I started getting a bit misty-eyed towards the end of that. I don't know about you, lads.
It's that thing where, you know, it's a reminder of better times. And, you know, I love talking about that sort of stuff. But, you know, as soon as you sort of say those words, he made his debut at the Nou Camp, it's like, oh, Christ, Newcastle actually were at the Nou Camp. And it's, to have that career. He's such a lovely fella. He is such a lovely fella. And I kind of always wished a little bit that he projected himself a bit more, not stood up for himself, because I'm sure he's capable of doing that, but sort of, you know, believed in his own talent a bit more, because he was a really good footballer. You know, he was a really good footballer, and he was dedicated as they come. If you don't love Aaron Hughes a bit, there's something wrong with you.
He's one of those players that always comes up in the conversation, doesn't he? When we say most underrated Newcastle player, or player you wish hadn't left, or player that shouldn't have left, or, you know, who did a job for you every week. It's always Aaron Hughes' name that gets mentioned in those conversations, isn't it, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, when I was an even squeakier voiced youth, I think I was about 13.
That's not
when
possible.
Aaron Hughes...
Impossible.
When Aaron Hughes was in the process of being sold to Aston Villa, the one and only time that I called up Century Radio's three legends and spoke to Malcolm McDonald was basically for me to profess my love for Aaron Hughes and say about how I was devastated that Newcastle would even consider selling him, never mind follow through with that. So yes, he was just...
I like how you've done that now when he's gone.
I know.
Didn't say that to him when he was here.
Well, I just get the impression you get quite bashful about things like that. Yeah, I did bottle it a little
bit. Yeah, he would. I can tell you, he's the kind of man that you sort of want to hug, but definitely doesn't want to be hugged. I think it's just one of those.
Oh, yeah.
And that makes you want to hug him even more. But he's a great fella. That's a lovely story, Chris. We'll have to tell him that. We'll have to make sure he hears that.
Well, chaps, thank you very much. It's been great fun. I've had a really, really lovely time talking to Aaron and listening to his tales of his career. Of course, all of you out there listening, thank you very much for tuning in. Thank you to everybody on Twitter who sent questions in for Aaron as well. There were some absolute belters in there. I'm sorry we didn't get through more of them, but we are, as always, restricted for time with this. If you can, get yourself on theathletic.com/NewcastlePod and pick up your 40% discount for a subscription. There's lots and lots more stuff going on there at the moment, and obviously if there's any updates on takeover or anything else, that'll be where it appears from George first and from Chris as well. Thank you very much for listening. Look after yourselves, take care of your families, stay safe, stay indoors, and we shall see you very, very soon. Thanks a lot. Bye bye.